From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The world recently marked the 500th anniversary of the events that launched the Protestant Reformation. A Duke University expert joins us to help explore that event's ongoing importance, including to American political life. State lawmakers recently reviewed North Carolina's opioid epidemic and its impact. You'll hear highlights from their discussion. Legislators have been debating the best way for North Carolina to select judges. Merit selection? Elections? You'll hear some of the information they learned from a UNC expert who's also a former top state judicial administrator. Plus, we'll highlight a new group that's looking at the confusing system North Carolina uses to fund its public schools. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina should take steps to stop state and local law enforcement agencies from working with the federal government in civil asset forfeiture equitable sharing programs. Why? Well, because our next guest says that these programs threaten North Carolinians' property rights, putting innocent people at risk. That is the primary message of a new John Locke Foundation Spotlight report written by John Guzet, Director of Legal Studies. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Donna. Glad to be here.
First of all, what is civil asset forfeiture for those of us who aren't attorneys?
Well, it's a very strange sort of legal process. It's one that we really didn't have anything of in this country for, well over 100 years. It's kind of like what used to happen in the Middle Ages when the authorities would put an animal or a tree or an inanimate object on trial for a crime. This is a case where the government, instead of going after the owner of property and proving that that person acquired that property in an illegal manner, say through they either used it to commit a crime or it was the proceeds of a crime, they don't do that at all. Instead, they bring an action against the property itself, and they bring what it's called civil asset forfeiture because it's a civil action, which means they don't have to prove that this was acquired or used in an illicit way beyond a reasonable doubt the way you would have to do in a criminal trial. What applies is the preponderance of the evidence standard. What that means is they simply have to show it's slightly more likely than not that this property was tainted in some way.
To whom do they have to illustrate that before they can actually seize my property, John?
Well, they just have to convince a judge or magistrate. It depends on the jurisdiction. This doesn't even come before a jury unless, in the unlikely event that the owner of the property is sophisticated enough, has enough resources, and of course is innocent enough to bring an action to get the property back. Because another thing that makes this different from a criminal proceeding is the burden is on the person whose property was taken to go to court and make their case and prove by the preponderance of evidence standard that they're innocent.
When we say property, that they can seize property, what is that? Is it just like a house?
Any kind of property. Houses have been taken. Cars are very often taken. And cash can be taken, too. A typical instance of this might be if the police pull somebody over, they see or they ask to search or in one way or another they become aware of the fact that there's a large sum of cash in the vehicle, they'll take the cash on the assumption that why would anybody be carrying a lot of cash unless they were involved in narcotics or some kind of other illegal activity.
Well, John, you're describing how this occurs in North Carolina. So are you telling me that it is legal in North Carolina?
Well, yes and no, Donna. We actually have one of the best asset forfeiture regimes in the country. In North Carolina, most of the time, there are a few exceptions, but most of the time, if the police think that some property has been used for a crime or was acquired through criminal activity, they can seize the property, which is right and proper, but they have to show that they have to bring a charge against the owner. The owner has to be charged with a crime, and they have to prove by at least a preponderance of evidence standard that that property was, in fact, used to commit the crime or was acquired through a crime. So That's the way it's done under North Carolina law. That's the way it ought to be done. The only reason North Carolinians have really got to worry about this other process, which is civil asset forfeiture as opposed to criminal forfeiture, is because federal laws are being used in North Carolina to preempt state law. And that's the problem that we're addressing in this paper.
So you are saying that there are local law enforcement agencies in North Carolina who are somehow working with the federal government on this civil asset forfeiture? And if that's the case, what do they get out of it?
Well, they get a lot of the proceeds. The way this works, the federal government revived civil asset forfeiture as a sort of a novel tool in the war against drugs back in the 70s. It was codified by federal law in the 1980s, and the feds started using it in a big way. Gradually, most states put in place their own civil asset forfeitures, but to our credit, North Carolina never did that. Our legislature, in its wisdom, could see that this was a violation of due process and a violation of North Carolinians' property rights, and they didn't go along. However, the feds also started encouraging state and local law enforcement agencies to take advantage of federal laws. And the way it works is this. If that state policeman pulls over a driver and takes their cash, or if they take the vehicle, or if they take a house, they can go before a federal magistrate and have that magistrate process the seizure under federal civil asset forfeiture laws. And then through a through a program that's called equitable sharing, 80% typically of the proceeds go back to the law enforcement agency that made the seizure. And if I might just digress for a moment, part of what makes this so egregious in North Carolina is under our state constitution, all fines and forfeitures are meant to be used specifically for public education in this state. That's a very good feature of our constitution, and it keeps law enforcement honest because they have nothing to gain by bending the rules and taking people's property without convicting them of a crime. The feds don't do that. And as a result, this is a way local law, state and local law enforcement can get the proceeds rather than have them diverted to public education as they ought to be.
This is a cash incentive plan then.
It is. It's very much an incentive, and it's a perverse incentive. And that, to my mind, is one of the most worrying things about it. We in North Carolina haven't had nearly the problems with relations between the public and the police that many other states have seen. And part of the reason for that is that our police agencies still have a lot of integrity. They haven't been perverted. Their relationship with the public hasn't been perverted the way it has in some states when, you know, the public, instead of being the ones to be defended by the police, become their prey. We don't want that to happen in North Carolina.
When you think about this, John, if we try to put ourselves in the shoes of a North Carolina law enforcement agency, if they know that the program exists, and clearly they do, this federal sharing program, one can understand that the incentive is there. So in some ways, you can see it's perfectly understandable that they would go ahead and engage in this.
It is. And I have no doubt that most of the time, the people whose property is being taken are bad guys. I'm sure that much of this property is property that ought to be forfeited because it was used for a crime or it was the proceeds of a crime. But that doesn't change the fact that in North Carolina, we think people have the right to due process, and the police or anyone else ought to have to prove those allegations before they can take that property.
There also seems to be an issue of then the federal government really getting involved in a state's business.
That's right. I mean, if you like to speak in terms of states' rights, this is a perfect example. The feds are undermining the protections that our legislature in its wisdom put into and our people in their wisdom put into our statutes and into our Constitution. This isn't a federal matter. It's a state matter, and we should do things the way we think is right and just in North Carolina.
What should North Carolina policymakers do about this? What can they do?
Well, there is some things they can do. A number of states have already put in place some laws that limit that put limits on how much state or when and under what circumstances state and local law enforcement can participate in equitable sharing. I think we can do at least that much in North Carolina. And if we wanted to, if the will was there, we could put a stop to it altogether.
And the numbers, John, are very interesting. How much money are we talking about here that North Carolina has derived from this in 2016?
Well, our research, we found that between 2007 and 2016, both between them, the Department of Treasury and the Department of Justice had shared $170 million in equitable sharing proceeds. That is to say, they'd sent that much money back to North Carolina law enforcement agencies. The fact is, this is dwarfed by the amount of money that the Department of Justice is taking from North Carolinians on its own behalf, and we can't really do anything about that, but we can certainly do something about what they're the way they're tending to corrupt our agencies.
We've been talking with John Guzet, Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation, about his new report on civil asset forfeiture. You can read it at johnlocke.org. John, thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke with an E dot org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. 500 years after Martin Luther launched what became the Protestant Reformation, his actions still exert a profound effect, and that includes a major impact on modern-day American political debates. How so? Our next guest addressed that question during a recent presentation for the John Locke Foundation. He is Dr. Michael Gillespie, Professor of Political Science and Philosophy at Duke University. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So first of all, before we get into how this has impacted things in America and American political and philosophical debates, remind us just how significant an impact this event had. Martin Luther supposedly nailing the 95 Theses on the door in Wittenberg.
Well, we know now that he probably didn't nail them on the door, but it is fascinating because within 3 weeks of his having published the 95 Theses, they were known all the way across Europe. Part of this is just an indication of the new power of the media, which is to say the printing press. We've seen some of that again today with the rapidity with which news travels from one place to another. But for Europe, this was the first European-wide event that really was occasioned by the publication of these 95 Theses, which turned an obscure German monk into a historical figure.
And after he published these theses and got all the attention and we ended up seeing the Reformation, one of the things that you talk about in your presentation is the way that different strains of this thought moved around to various countries and ended up coming to impact America in more than one way.
Well, yes. And we think of, we think of our own differences between secularism and evangelicalism, for example. And we imagine that they come from two different sources, when in fact you can trace them all back to Luther's 95 Theses in a kind of strange way. And partly that is the distinction between what we sometimes call the Magisterial Reformation and the Radical Reformation. The Magisterial Reformation, which includes Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli, went off in one direction that really imagined an omnipotent God who could do anything, but diminish the capacity for human freedom being able to affect one's theological fate. The Radical Reformation, by contrast, really wanted to emphasize human freedom and the role that human beings could play in determining their own lives. Over time, as you trace out the various paths of these things, we're prone to think that the Magisterial Reformation was central and important for us because it does help to explain religion that we see around us today. But in fact, without understanding the Radical Reformation, and particularly the role that freedom played within the Radical Reformation, it's hard to understand what happened to Protestantism. So Protestantism today, for the most part, even among evangelicals, is imagined to be a religion in which people have a choice about whether to stand with Christ or not. The Magisterial Reformers, Calvin and Luther, certainly didn't believe that. That had a lot to do with intervening history, particularly Jacobus Arminius, the Wesleys, the origins of Methodism, baptism, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, within the Radical Reformation, there were strong concerns about the role that Christ actually played in the Godhead. And as a result, the relationship between man and God, and particularly between man and Christ, should Christ be seen as a transcendent God, or should Christ be seen as preeminently a moral model on which we should model our behavior? Within the Radical Reformation, and particularly among the anti-Trinitarians, the Quakers, and others, the notion of inner light, the role of reason, played a huge role. And we know now that John Locke, after whom the foundation is named, was in fact probably a Socinian, an anti-Trinitarian, who believed that reason and reason's God alone was sufficient for us to lead our moral and religious lives. And insofar as he became the founder of what we think of as classical liberalism and one of the preeminent forms of secular life, we see that transferred into America through a number of his writings, but also through the continuation of anti-Trinitarians coming to the United States, then called Unitarians. And particularly Joseph Priestley, the very famous scientist, came, was friends with Jefferson, with Franklin, and with Washington, and during that period of the American founding had a profound impact upon their thinking about religion and politics. In the 1820s, with the Second Great Awakening, we saw a counterpunch to that from Calvinism. And, that has in a way shaped the American landscape ever since, a secular view of religion and life and a more Calvinist view of evangelicalism. What's so interesting to me is that both of them, in a certain sense, derive from Luther, right, and have shaped the way in which we think about the world for better and for worse, and that this religious conflict remains essential to everything we think about in American life.
That is the voice of Dr. Michael Gillespie, professor of political science and philosophy at Duke University. Some people may be listening, and some of the names are familiar or not, but among our listeners who would not consider themselves particularly religious or even spiritual, if they say, oh, all this religious stuff, it doesn't really matter to me, it doesn't have much of an impact on my life, how much of this really does impact the things that people are dealing with day in and day out in terms of the politics and philosophy?
Well, I think the at the core, and there are a number of people that have attacked religion as the source of everything that goes wrong in human life. They consider themselves secular, anti-religious. In point of fact, almost all of them believe in some version of the Christian message, even if they don't believe in Christ. And one of the examples I like to use on that is the whole idea of rights. You know, we imagine that rights are something intrinsic to human beings. It's written in our Declaration of Independence. It's assumed by the Constitution. The Bill of Rights specifies the rights that we have. But we imagine that it has a foundation beyond merely our own making, rooted either in nature or nature's God, as Jefferson put it. In point of fact, almost all of modern science denies the existence of individual human rights. Right? What matters, if you believe in modern biology, is not the individual, but species. And what I try to show, and what I tried to show in my previous book, The Theological Origins of Modernity, and in the current book I'm working on, which is going to be called The Theological Fate of Modernity, is that that things like rights are really a holdover from Christianity, and that they're deeply embedded in our psyche in ways that we don't understand and that are essentially Christian. Now, Muslims understand this because when you tell them that they ought to, you know, honor human rights, they see that as a Western imposition because they recognize that it's a Christian notion and not something compatible with their religion.
Well, it's a very interesting topic and one that the discussion, I hope, convinces people that even if they haven't focused much on this 500th anniversary of Martin Luther and the theses being published in Wittenberg, Germany, that they should, because it has an impact on our lives today. That is the voice of Dr. Michael Gillespie, professor of political science and philosophy at Duke University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for being here.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams. Visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers recently learned that three people die in the state each day from opioid abuse, and that number might soon jump from three to four. Republican State Senator John Alexander aimed a basic question about opioids at Dr. Susan Kinsagra of the State Division of Public Health.
I've got a criticism that I've had of this opioid thing for some time is that people talk about opioids, but we don't know the street names of these things. If somebody would ask me, do you have any opioids in your medicine cabinet? I said, no, I don't. I used to have some Percocet in there when I had some back surgery a few years ago, and I think he probably prescribed about seven or eight pills, took two or three of them, and then the rest of them I left up in the little container. Well, we've had people go in and out of our house doing different things. The container's there. The pills are gone. I didn't take them. Somebody who was inside my house went in my medicine cabinet and got those. So is there a reason, I mean, maybe the top five or ten and say, these are opioids, people. Why aren't you doing that?
I think you raise an excellent point, and I think that's something we need to increasingly do, because you're right. Using the word opioids is a broad term, and making sure that people are aware that we're talking about Percocet, Vicodin, oxycodone, oxycodone, using all of those names. And we do that in some of our more community-based presentations. It's a little bit easier to use the term opioids here, but I think your point is well taken, and we need to think about how we use those names.
Republican Representative Michael Speciale offered state health officials another idea.
One of the biggest things I think would help is what you've got already noted in here, is making people aware of where they can take these drugs. I had a family member pass away a couple of months ago, and it was probably a week ago that I finally found somewhere I could get rid of that whole pile of drugs, all kinds of opioids and all kinds of stuff, you know, from previous hip surgeries and things like that, that we collected from her house. And it's like, okay, what do I do with this? And it took me a while to find out. I mean, I went to pharmacies and said, hey, you guys take this stuff back? And they said no. And finally one of them told me to try police department or sheriff's department, and I finally did find somewhere to get rid of it. But I think somehow getting the word out to the public that what the avenues are to get rid of this stuff, so they don't A, have to throw it in the garbage, B, let it sit in their medicine cabinets, and everybody's got extra drugs. So I think somehow we've got to get the word out and let people know where they can get rid of this stuff.
DOI actually has a Safe Kids Initiative, which is the initiative that they promote around drug take back. And if we go to their website, they have a list of common locations, but we absolutely need to do more to promote it and make sure people are aware of those locations.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative hearing on North Carolina's problem with opioid abuse. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day: jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina recently returned political party labels to all elections involving judges, but there's still an ongoing debate about the best way to place judges on the bench. A legislative committee recently heard a history lesson on the topic from James Drennan, a professor at the UNC School of Government. Drennan started with survey results showing what people want from their judges.
They want them to be, in addition to knowing the law, which is a pretty good thing for a judge, they want them to be honest, fair, unbiased, good managers, hardworking, consistent, speedy. People want those kinds of judges. What they don't agree about is how to select judges to do that, to be that person. They don't know, there's no agreement universally about how to weigh the various qualities or how to even assess the various qualities. These days, the question of what the role of a judge is not a settled question. And then this is the big question in any selection system. How do you balance the need to hold the judge accountable and yet promote a system where the judge can be independent to do the hard work of judging that often involves making people mad? When the law says one thing and the popular opinion sort of moves in a different place. That's the hard thing for judges.
Drennan says any system of selecting judges needs to deal with some basic challenges.
You got to figure out, how do you get candidates? How do you get the best people to want to be this really important work of being a judge? And in thinking about that, how do you provide enough security to get the right people to apply? Because what you're doing is asking lawyers who have careers to decide to give it up to take this job. And you all know what it's like. You all run for office. You know what it's like to think about losing or maybe even losing. If it's your career, your vocation, and your source of income, that sort of doubles down on that level of analysis you do when you decide whether to jump into this pool.
Drennan reminded lawmakers that the federal government has judges appointed for life by the president with confirmation from the U.S. Senate.
States, on the other hand, use five different methods, one of which is appointment by the executive, similar to the federal system. Another is appointment by the legislature. A couple of states do that. Partisan elections, seven or eight states do that. Nonpartisan elections, about 20-something states do that. And then this sort of confusing animal called merit selection. But if you look at all that, if you're concerned about federalism, it's alive and well in the state court system because no single state looks exactly like any other state. It's a constant experimentation at the state level. And when you're building your system, you have to figure out how you're going to fill vacancies, how you're going to fill full terms, and what kind of retention system once you get in there that you're going to have. And there are choices at every one of those stages.
You're listening to highlights from a recent presentation by Professor James Drennan of the UNC School of Government. He offered more details about some of the judicial selection procedures used across the country.
Appointments, which is the federal model, basically, is a northeastern phenomenon. Some of them have terms of office, but they're very long terms of office, like 14 or 16 years. But many of them have indefinite terms similar to the federal system.
Not all states with judicial appointments rely on the governor.
The legislative appointment, which is kind of a reaction to the executive appointment created at the same time as the legislative appointment, was adopted by Virginia and South Carolina. They're the only two states who do that. In South Carolina, there is a screening process. In Virginia, there's no formal screening process.
Most states without judicial appointments rely instead on elections.
Partisan elections began to appear in this country about the time of Andrew Jackson. And in large part, it was a reaction to a view that the power was being concentrated in either the legislative or the executive branch, and the people wanted their say. It's currently used in Pennsylvania, Illinois, Alabama, Louisiana, North Carolina for all courts. New York, Indiana, and Tennessee for the trial courts, and Texas for the appellate courts. That's the traditional understanding of partisan elections. You go through a party primary or other selection process. When there is an election, their parties are identified on the ballot, and the person who gets the most vote wins.
Some states use party labels for judicial races. Others do not.
In the early 20th century, part of the progressive era of about 100 years ago that you all studied in school, a lot of different things began to happen. One of them that began to appear was the idea of a nonpartisan election, trying to, again, get away from the influence of the political bosses, if you will, to, again, get to the people in whatever way people were trying to do it. So candidates in those systems run without party designation. That's largely a Midwestern, Western phenomenon, although it is scattered across the country. And it's the most common form of selecting trial judges. 21 states do it that way. There's no majority rule in this country when it comes to selecting judges. And it is also used in appellate judges, but not quite as much as it is at the trial courts.
Drennan says all of these systems of selecting judges have to answer difficult questions.
How do you provide independence, which is a key fact of a good court system? We learn from the British. Don't take judges' pay and reduce it. They get terms of office. And then there's some informal ways as well. How can you hold judges accountable? There are some tools. Elections is one. Judicial Standards Commission exists when judges cross the bounds of good behavior. There's a Judicial Standards Commission that you all are familiar with that can discipline the judge. Judges can be prosecuted. We've had judges, regrettably, who've been prosecuted for criminal conduct. Judges have statutes that require them to step away from a case if they have a conflict of interest. We have appellate courts to review cases. We have a strong media presence to provide information, and the judicial evaluations that some states do are all available.
Drennan says there's no easy answer to the question of how to select the best judges.
I was talking to one of my judge friends, and I said, well, what do I go talk to these people, these political scientists, about selecting judges? And he said, there ain't no good way to do it. Because every system has strengths and weaknesses. And I think he's right at some level, because every system is in constant tension. How much independence do you want to build into the system, and how much accountability do you want to build into the system? Because they are often in tension with each other. And which what all states are trying to do is trying to find that sweet spot where the judge is appropriately accountable, but the system promotes an independence of mind that you that classically we expect judges to have. And so the states are still doing that. They started in 1776. It's 2017. There were six or eight legislatures looking at these issues this year. They're still trying to figure out that balance. Independence, accountability.
That's Professor James Drennan of the UNC School of Government. He's discussing differences in judicial selection processes among the 50 states. He delivered this message to North Carolina lawmakers. They're considering these same issues. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams. Visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina will spend roughly $9 billion this fiscal year on educating kids in kindergarten through high school. That's about 39%, or $3.90 of every $10 that's actually in the general operating budget for the state. But now there are growing questions over how the state divvies up all this money. And those questions have resulted in the creation of a legislative task force. And our next guest, Dr. Terry Stoops, is following very closely what this task force is doing. It's held its first meeting. He, of course, is the Vice President for Research, Director of Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So first of all, what has legislators so concerned? I think we've been pretty much spending the money the same way for many, many years.
Well, a few years ago, legislators asked the Program Evaluation Division of the legislature to look at the way that we fund schools, what kind of mechanisms are in place for distributing state funds. And they released that report in November 2016. And I think they were surprised about what they saw in that report, just how confusing, the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability that is in the way that we fund schools in North Carolina. I think they were just as confused as all of us have been with the mechanisms that we have in place to fund schools.
So fast forward a year later since that report, and they've held their first meeting at the very first day of November. You've been following this. What transpired?
This first meeting of the task force was just really an overview of the Program Evaluation Division report. And the report is really what is bringing all of this up. The report had two recommendations after it examined all the different ways that we fund education in North Carolina. And just as a brief overview, we have 37 allotment categories. Just think of it as 37 boxes that we put different amounts of money in for schools. And then we send it to these schools in these 37 boxes, and then they can spend some in some ways and can't spend some in other ways. So it is a really confusing way of funding schools. In fact, I've heard people that work at Department of Public Instruction sometimes admit that they don't quite get how this all works together. But so they made two recommendations. The first is just to blow up the system and find a new, better, more transparent, more accountable way to fund public schools. Or to make adjustments to the existing system, perhaps collapse some of these categories, have fewer boxes of funds for school districts to use, and maybe make it a little easier to trace how the money goes to the school districts and then how it's spent.
Terry, some folks believe that wealthier counties are receiving a lot more money to educate kids than some of our poorer counties. And that's a common refrain that you hear from people on all sides of the ideological spectrum. Is that accurate?
Well, according to the report, there is some evidence to back up the idea that the wealthier counties are doing a better job of getting money from the system than some of our poorer counties. It's that kind of inequality that really a lot of legislators are paying attention to, because a lot of the leadership in the North Carolina General Assembly come from rural communities. And if they feel like the urban communities and suburban communities are getting more money, they're, of course, going to want to pay attention to that. So I think that's one of the biggest concerns that legislators have, is that the money that we spend on education in North Carolina is not going to those counties that need it the most. And to a lot of legislators, they believe that the ones that need it the most are in rural communities.
Before we talk about some of those ideas and this question of do we blow up the whole system, so to speak, or do we try to just change what we have, tell us where the money comes from. It's not just state dollars that goes into the overall education pot.
Right. We have around two-thirds of our money come from the state, and the state really distributes the money according to this allotment system that they have in place. So they have a great deal of control how the money is delivered to the school districts. The federal government provides between 10 and 15% of the funding, and then the rest come from local tax dollars, county tax dollars. So that's one of the reasons why this is such an important issue, because the state government controls so much of the education funding in this state. That was a system that was set up in the 1930s to try to make sure that the funding was distributed to North Carolina counties that needed the most. So that idea, the idea that the state pays most of the bill, is not really an issue here. The issue is, how is that money distributed to the school districts, and is it being distributed in an equitable way?
Let's talk more about that then, because you set out really two options: to either do something completely different or to try to reform what we're doing right now. What's your recommendation between those two?
My recommendation would be to go to a weighted student funding model. And this basically looks at a student and says, what does this individual student need? And attaches dollar amounts to those student needs. So, for example, all students would be there would be a base amount of money for each student. And then depending on that student's needs, additional money would be added. Let's say that they're in a low-income county, or they have special needs, or they're in a career and technical education program. And that money would be stacked on top of that base amount, so that each student would have a pot of money set aside for their needs specifically, rather than just entire categories of money being sent to the district. A lot of people have called this backpack funding, because this is, in essence, making sure that each of the kids in the district have the amount of money attached to them that they would need to be successful.
Help us understand how that approach, the weighted approach, is different from how the money is allocated today.
Well, the student weighted funding model looks at the individual student and looks at what their individual student needs are. The current way that we fund money is basically to look at large enrollment trends. So, for example, for special needs students, how many are in the district? And then it restricts the amount of money depending on what percentage of special needs students you have. up to 12.75%. So basically, instead of looking at large groups of students and how many of those students are in the district and then how much money goes with that large group of students, this is just a way to fund the individual student and to recognize that each student is different and has different needs. And funding whole categories of students is really not a wise way to go about funding education in the state.
Terry, what you're talking about really makes sense as you explain it. But on the other hand, it sounds very complex, looking at every student as an individual. And I think we would want that. But how do you go about that in a bureaucracy?
Well, we've seen states already implement it. And that's the really great thing about weighted student funding is that we wouldn't be doing something that states like California, for example, aren't already doing. And there are great models out there. The real question is how much money would we attach for those various student needs? In other words, let's say they come from a low-income county. How much additional funding would we give to that student for being in a low-income county? Those are matters of percentages and how much money is available and how much can be distributed. So that's really where the argument is going to come from. How much should we give for those things? Not necessarily should we fund them.
And that's likely to be a big, big argument because when you're talking about the state legislature, you have people who are representing literally every single community in the state. So if we were to actually go about this big change, would this be something that we could do quickly, or is this a multi-year effort?
This is going to be a multi-year effort, but fortunately, we've taken the first step. And the John Locke Foundation has been talking about this for years, and we're really encouraged to see legislators taking the first step to a more rational, transparent, and accountable way of funding public schools.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. Terry, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.